and welcome to the In the Money Players Podcast. This is our Breeders' Cup Review Edition. I'm your host, Peter Thomas Fornital, back with you from the Brooklyn Bunker once again. And I'm going to be in the bunker a whole lot the next 4 days as I'm in deep quarantine here. Got the first test back today, and that came out negative. So that's good news. Another man who's on the road, heading back to the planet Texas. Actually, he might have just landed there and be driving across the planet Texas as we speak. You know, the intro to these shows that you always hear, it nearly changed over the weekend. It was nearly going to go from being what I usually say to the Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge champion. In the end, he fell one short of that, but he's still the people's champion. He's Jonathan Kinchin. What's up, JK?
Yeah, I am in the planet Texas. I'm in Dallas-Fort Worth. Just left the airport, driving back to Austin, and funny enough, standing in the baggage claim area, had a good day today. I felt like I had a good weekend. Felt like I made a couple of dollars. Obviously, one of my best, if it was my best day ever as a horse player. And just to kind of bring me back down to earth, I was standing next to Jeff Bloom of Midnight Bisou fame. So he did better than I did.
That's great stuff. Now, we're going to talk mostly about the races themselves. You're going to cover in great depth your score in the contest elsewhere. We'll talk about it a little bit, though. It would be a total host fail if we didn't at least touch on it a bit. I have to say, JK, that, you know, I've sat next to you during approximately 47 tournaments. I've never seen you play better. The efficiency and discipline you showed were much more than I've even seen you in other tournaments where, you know, I think you got gamble in you, and sometimes you like to you put it on the line, maybe to a fault. I didn't see any of that here. You played an unbelievable game. Obviously, the one person who beat you, who I imagine you don't even feel bad about that having happened. I'm very proud of you, and I know Big Ralph, proud of you too, brother. That was an awesome experience to watch, and we just want to check in with get your little emotional weather report here a couple days later.
It's feeling good, man. It's the Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge, the NHC, those are two masters, majors in this. You know, I compare it to the Masters we got coming up this weekend. There are two majors in this game, and as much as I'd love to win a big contest at Santa Anita, the Belmont Betting Challenge, something at Saratoga, or even the Grade One Gamble, these two contests just hit differently, and they're an important kind of piece of that horse player resume, if you will. And so I wanted to get the win, and like you said, if anyone was going to beat me, I could think of about three people in this world I'd be okay with. Marshall's one of them. And so it was an emotional ending to that, because once I played the doubles, I knew what I was alive to, and if you weren't with me, I would have called you. I check in with a couple of non-racing friends, checked in with the Matisses to kind of let them know what was going on. And then I started thinking, who else do I need to call? And I said, I'll call Marshall. I called Marshall and I started telling him. He stopped me mid-sentence to let me know that he was going to be firing away. So he didn't want to know what I was doing or what I was alive to. And then I thought to myself, I need to call my dad and tell him what I'm alive to. Mm-hmm. And that, that's kind of this emotion I've been going through since my dad passed, is that because he lived in a different city, it just still kind of feels like he lives in a different city right now. Mm-hmm. And so when I wasn't able to do that, that felt a little bit emotional, but I did send him a text message, before the race went off, and told him who we were alive to.
So you put that out in the ether, and it paid off. Unbelievable. It's one of those things, man. It'll happen to me today. You know, my dad passed in 2012, and I'll hear a song on the radio and be like, you know, I'll have some question about it or something. Like, oh, dad would know. Ah, darn it. You know, like it still happens. So I can only imagine, with everything so ratcheted up as it was, that the emotions were high. But like you said, your greatest day as a horse player, And you know, when you look at the difference between one and two, you made out a pretty darn well. For those that don't know, in the end, JK built his bankroll to $160,000. Additionally, takes home $215,000 in prize money, gets that NHC seat as well. Had you even qualified for the NHC before this, or is this how you're going to end up playing in next year's event?
That had not qualified. I hadn't really tried very much either, so it wasn't like I had a bunch of chances and blew them. Like I didn't. I had already kind of conceded that I wasn't going to play this year. I have a personal goal to just play in the NHC as long as possible. I started pretty young, not as young as our friend Eric Bielik and some others, but I started fairly young in my runs. And I admire what Duke and Paul Sherman and Paul have done with their long runs of NHC qualifications. And so I wanted to look back one day and be able to say, oh, this is my 37th in a row. And I was willing to concede it this year based on just 2020 as a whole.
Pandemic. Not a lot of traveling. Yeah, it makes sense.
I'd have no problem when I'm 64 hanging out at Bally's with some young bucks saying, I've been to 37 in a row. I don't count the one in 2020 that I missed. You know, I'd be okay with that story, but I won't have to worry about that yet.
Let's see. Given the differences in our ages, I'm not sure if I'll be able to be around for that one, that mythical moment or not, but I'm gonna try, JK. I'm going to try. It's great that the streak lives. I have a feeling this will make you much hungrier to qualify every year, keeping that streak going intact. So that's a good thing. Again, there'll be other shows this week on the network with you talking more about everything, but we obviously had to cover the basics of it. It's certainly a day at the races that I will never, ever forget. And in terms of looking back at the races, let's just start with the Breeders' Cup Classic, JK, a race where Authentic really proved his mettle, gets the job done. I believe the official buyer speed figure, now that they've gotten some more info about the clock, it's going to end up being a 111, his best performance on the clock. I have to say I was a little bit surprised he didn't see some more pressure on the lead. Do you agree with that assessment? And what did you think of Authentic and his performance in this year's Breeders' Cup Classic?
I mean, I think there's another horse that we'll talk about later that can kind of be involved in this conversation, and that's Nick's Go. And I think the problem is a lot of horses, a lot of connections, a lot of trainers, they just don't have I don't want to say the courage, that might not be the right word. They're just scared of going too fast. And they would rather go, I guess they would prefer to go slower and lose than go too fast and lose. And Authentic was dead set on getting the lead. And you know, Bob Baffert had been pretty clear about that. He had been pretty clear, you know, to us when we saw him at Jeff Ruby. And I even think he said it publicly that he felt like Johnny not going to the front end was a mistake in the Preakness, and that was obviously not going to be what happened in this situation. He was going to go to the front end. He went to the front end, and no one decided to go with him. I think that some of the candidates to go with him were also trained by the same person, and knowing what the instructions were to the lead at all cost, I think that there's a reason that makes sense to me why a Maximum Security or an Improbable don't go to the front end if you know that another horse that's pretty good is hell-bent on getting to the front. Why would you want to get into a ding-dong with that one? Hope that that one who just got beat by a filly that didn't win the distaff comes back to you, right? I mean, I guess I'm a little bit surprised he was as loose as he was, but I'm also not shocked. Like, there's no dead speed horse in there that had no excuse to not be on the lead.
The horse to me that should have gone to the lead, and this isn't just hindsight because we talked about it, and this will get into one of the other big talking points of the race. I want to give Authentic his props a little bit more first. He looked amazing in the paddock. He really looked the part, ran a great race. They might have been hell-bent on getting the lead, but really, for a horse of his caliber, ended up being an easy lead. He uplined throughout the race. That means each one of his pace figures was faster than the last, which shows you he was well within himself. To me, and look, with what Manny Franco's been through today, and we'll talk about that in a minute, I hate to be the guy lumping on. But, I mean, the horse broke on top. We know he doesn't like running down inside. I think you got to let him use his speed and not get in a wrestling match with him. Now, I've heard other sharp people say, well, he found so little, maybe it didn't matter. I don't think it works that way. You know, I think he just gave away all hope at getting any sort of good position and put in a non-effort that I'm not willing to say that he's, you know, not as good. I mean, yeah, he's probably not as good as we thought he was, right? Because the horse that we saw in the Travers probably could overcome anything, or at least the horse I thought he was coming out of the Travers. But this is a horse in Tis the Law I'm willing to give another chance. Now, all that said, and even though, you know, I'm not a jockey knocker and I just jockey knocked, this is my job as an analyst to objectively report what I see in races. When you have a business relationship with somebody, even if that business relationship, as I'm sure it is in the process of ending, to go and knock a guy publicly, and then you might want to say, ah, oh, you know, he's old, he's cranky, he's not media savvy, Barkley Tag, who said a comment. The comment was something to the effect of, I can only get him ready to run, I can't ride him. It was a very obvious and nasty knock. I'm not willing to just say, oh, he's old and cranky and da-da-da, because he just got in a media kerfuffle, nearly getting the sport of horse racing canceled in front of the Kentucky Derby with his foolish comments. So this will make everybody on both sides mad, right? Because the Manny defenders are going to be mad that I'm knocking Manny, and then the Barkley defenders are going to be mad when I say I thought it was classless and awful, and I'm not sure he's a very good guy, JK. What do you think?
Well, look, if Barkley gets him ready, but he can't ride him, then he screwed up the Derby. How about that? So that's the first thing. They're even. How about there? Barkley and Barkley let Manny down at the Derby, and Manny let Barkley down in the Classic. We were all saying, and I said it. We said this all the way back to the three old races in Florida. When you tell a rider, hey, go out there, go 40 miles per hour on a 1,200 pound animal. It's the biggest horse you'll ever ride, and don't screw it up, because if you do even a little bit, we're taking you off the horse. Okay, good. Go have fun. And Manny overcame that and did well enough to work out some good situations, winning the Belmont, winning the Travers. Well, I can assure you, I would assume Manny probably got a lot more confidence in those two races, but it's still in the back of his head that if I screw up, I'm going to get fired. And going ding-dong with a horse that everyone knew was going to the front on the front end, that and then getting turned away or fading to fourth, he's going to get in trouble then too. Why would you go to the... I can hear it right now. Why would you go 47 with a horse that won the Derby? Why would you go 47 with a horse that everyone in the world knew was going to the front? Like, whatever. And so it was a lose-lose. Manny got what he needed to get out of Tis the Law. And if I was Manny and Angel Cordero, I would be thinking more along the lines of good riddance.
Well, let's talk about the ride specifically. I mean, forget about what's going on in his head. Forget about the reasons he might have made the mistake. Do you agree with me that it was a mistake? It's the kind of ride I hear you criticize all the time. So I'm going to be kind of surprised if you disagree with me on this. But, you know, it's your prerogative too.
Yeah, I mean, it's in hindsight. But if the horse would have shut off a little bit more, Barkley, then maybe him sitting down inside would have actually worked that pocket trip. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that trip. I mean, yes. In a perfect world, if I needed Tis the Law for all the money in the world, I would have preferred him go in front of Authentic and go on with it. I think that was one of the reasons why I hated the draw for Tis the Law anyways. I thought he could win, but I just worried that getting down in there was going to be problematic. It was going to cause situations like this. That now we're sitting here on Monday trying to figure out, you know, what happened. Well, really, it was the draw. We don't have this conversation if he draws the 10. He's just sitting around there, three wide, three wide, three wide, and we see what happens and see if he was good enough and see if Barkley Tag had him ready. But in this situation, when he's drawn down in there, he was throwing his head. Manny got him in tight, too, for a second. When you look at that blimp view right when they're coming off of the first turn, he almost had to check out of there. I mean, he saved every step of ground in the first part of the race. I just, you know, I mean, I think it's just one of those hindsight situations. It's a very slippery slope in horse racing.
Yeah, I mean, you're being kind, I think, but you're making good points at the same time. I just feel like when he shows that much natural speed, if you go on with it, you've still got, you're in the clear, you're out. Even if Authentic wants to go, you don't necessarily have to engage at that point. You can flop outside and get your trip. Like, I thought it was win-win when he broke so sharply to go on with it. The hammerlock that resembled Bob Backlund's crossface wasn't what I was looking for there.
No, but here's the thing. I agree. It was not a great ride, right? But I didn't have a daughter. I had a son, which I'm glad I don't have to worry about this. But when Perrin is 16 years old and she wants to go to the movies with that boy, and you don't let her go, and she's gonna find a way to screw it up. And when you tell a rider over and over again that if he messes up, he's in trouble, you're not putting him in his mindset to make the best possible decision.
I can't disagree with that.
It's just a bad situation. You know, he did. He probably screwed it up, but it's also a hindsight, you know.
I have a lot of sympathy for Manny Franco in the overarching situation, and I think of the two crimes in my mind, you know, crime is a strong word for giving a suboptimal ride. But to me, if I'm choosing between whose side I'm on, giving a suboptimal ride and eviscerating somebody verbally in a classless manner, out of not riding the 1,000-pound animal going 40 miles an hour, having just had a major PR gaffe within, you know, 2.5 news cycles, to me, clearly the greater error in judgment is that of Barkley Tagg. That's how I see it. So again, everybody on either side could be mad at me, but that's just how I see it. And we'll go on from there. And by the way, Bob Backlund didn't do a crossface. It was like this cool chicken wing armbar. I'm sure some of the wrestling geeks out there will correct me. Before we move on from the classic JK, improbable. Looked like he ran his race. He had the worst trip of the two, I would say. Some people have said, oh, he was best because of the ground loss. I'm not so sure that the outside wasn't where you wanted to be a little bit on the day. Not that it was some super dead rail, but the rail on Saturday to me did not nearly appear to be the advantage that it was on Friday. What did you think? Who was better between Authentic and Improbable?
I think it's just a little bit closer. It's a hard game to play. I don't think it was drastic either way. I think it was probably a closer race in the end if Improbable would have been able to save some ground. Also, Irad tried to middle move on the backside to be able to try to get into better position, but I think maybe it was Maximum Security was kind of staying right there, so he ended up being four wide again. He lost a lot of ground, especially for a horse that a lot of people would still say has questions about the mile and a quarter. You know, even though he's won that race at a mile and a quarter, it was over a kind of an average field. Facing this field for a horse that had question marks about a mile and a quarter, I would say that ground loss was significant. So I will tell you this, though. If he was best, that makes my stomach hurt a little bit because I needed him for $293,000.
Oh, JK, you won $300-something. Let's break out the world's smallest violin for you, okay? I think Improbable probably.
No, I'm just saying I could have.
Don't get greedy. I think Improbable probably was best, and for me, the ground loss is a little piece of it. The bigger thing is just in race flow terms. Like when you consider him being four back already going when they're going slow early. I mean they were both very, very good, obviously. But if you made me pick between the two, that's the way that I would go. We can't leave the classic without addressing the disappointment of the race in Tom's d'état. Did you see any excuse in particular for him?
No, I didn't really see an excuse. I've always felt this way about Tom, and then I've always felt this way about Tom's d'état. And then, you know, in fact, I tried to beat him that race at Churchill with by my standards that day, and he stuffed me in a locker and won by 12, and everyone thought I was an idiot. But what happened was he came back in that race at Saratoga in the Whitney. And because I thought Improbable was so good, and this is what I had said all week in interviews and stuff, because I liked Improbable so much, I thought Tom's d'état was the value based on missing the break and running it Improbable in the Whitney. But the truth is, I just think Improbable's probably a grade 2 plus type of horse. And I just don't think he's that kind of grade one, mile and a quarter, everyone's ready, firing their best shot type. And I think that we might have been reminded of that.
I think you misspoke there, JK. You said improbable, the grade two plus. You mean Tom's
Zatop. Tom's Zatop.
Clarify. It's hard to know. I mean, he did get jostled a little bit at the break. That's a trip I want to go back and watch again. But I mean, obviously, still a phenomenal training job for that horse to be in that position. He was a lot more interesting, you know, when we thought he was going to be 6-7 to 1. He ends up going off at 4 to 1, much closer to just the price. And, you know, I think he's a very good horse on his day. And to get a horse who's obviously had that many issues to put up some of the big efforts he did, it's still just an absolutely phenomenal training job. Anything else in the classic, JK, or should we talk about some of these other races?
No, I mean, I don't really have a lot to say about Max, except for the fact that I did see him for a second flash. And he was like the only danger I saw for a half a second, right when they turned for home. But, you know, I just don't, even though I think he kind of fooled us with a couple of performances, I don't think he's as good as he was for Jason Service.
I'll tell you this, on Friday's track, I think he'd have gone a lot closer because he did make that menacing looking move on the rail. Do you agree with that general idea, by the way, that it was a good rail Friday, by Saturday it had evened out or maybe even tilted a little bit the other way? Where are you on how the track played for the 2 days?
Yeah, I mean, the rail was definitely good on Friday. And Saturday, I just think – Saturday at this point, I just kind of would say, like, fair.
Yeah, I'll give you that.
You know, Monomoy Girl, you know, maybe she was supposed to win by more. Whitmore spent some time, like, towards the inside, even though he kind of – you know, so he was down in there a little bit. You know, so it just depends on how you want to look at it.
Yeah, I'm not saying it was a dead rail by any means. Just it was clearly different than it was the other day. I don't know how that we need to talk about the Breeders' Cup turf at great length, but we certainly need to acknowledge the awesome Tarnawa, one of the horses that really helped you out on the day. And this was a great example of something I feel like we've talked about many times on the show, that with Euros, the difference between grinding, and look no farther than Magical's run in there to see a great example of an impressive grinding finish, and then look at what Tarnawa did in the... I still haven't looked at the come-home times, but I'm guessing she's shading 22 seconds flat coming home with that turn of foot, basically powering by the entire field. Huge win for Colin Keane, champion jockey of Ireland, to get involved with a big international prize like this. And Dermot Weld hasn't won a Breeders' Cup race in a couple of decades, but what a stellar resume. And then the Aga Khan getting back to Breeders' Cup glory. It was a fantastic... Actually, I think I lied, JK. I'm not sure if Dermot Weld ever has won a Breeders' Cup race. I'll look that up while we're talking. But I think I was thinking of when Aga Khan won it a couple of decades ago, Breeders' Cup turf. But it was a stellar result, and I know it must have meant a whole lot to you. What were your takeaways from the Breeders' Cup turf?
Yeah, I mean, she was good, and like, you know, we watched the race together, and they were far back, and they weren't going very fast. So that was a little bit concerning. In the back of my head, I was just, man, I hope she quickens like a good one, and she did at the top of the stretch when she got into position. Channelmaker, I thought, ran well. You know, I think Channelmaker, you know, if, I don't know what the plans are with Channelmaker. I was fortunate enough to have dinner with Randy Hill on Saturday night, but I don't even know if we talked about that. He was trying to school me on Burgundy wine. So we didn't even talk much about Channelmaker, but if he comes back, you know, he's going to win a lot of races next year with what they found out he wants to do, which is go to the front end and go fast. And those turf marathons, he's going to be hard to beat in a lot of races.
Oh, my gosh. Think about the form of the two that beat him. I mean, it's two of the best middle-distance turf horses in Europe are the only two that ended up passing him. Yeah, that was Dermot Weld's first Breeders' Cup win, so that's huge. And Channelmaker probably has done enough to secure Turf Horse of the Year, or do you think they'd give it to Tarnawa just off the Breeders' Cup?
Well, you know, it's weird when they do that. I mean, I'm not really a huge fan of when they do that, when a horse comes over and runs once and then they give him an Eclipse Award. So I'd have to think who else is in there. I mean, Channelmaker would have a stinking argument. I tell you what, I mean, he's I think he won two grade ones and then he ran third to, like you said, the two of the best Europeans in the world. And so but it's probably not a good enough resume to win Turf Force of the Year.
I don't know. I think he's going to look pretty good when all is said and done, because you're not supposed to count the Tarnawa achievements overseas. So you're going to have two grade one. Well, we'll have plenty of time to debate this, so we'll put a pin in it for now. But just off the back of two grade ones and a cracking third to two killers in the turf, and you know, the mile division, you know, plenty of there's some parity in there. Anyway, plenty of time to talk about that. We'll move on. I mean, we could talk about the turf a lot more, but let's move on to Monomoy Girl. And there's a lot to talk about here. This performance, certainly one of the most memorable in terms of storyline for the entire Breeders' Cup, ends up getting the job done, reclaiming her distaff crown, and then making more news before the weekend's over. What were your takeaways from her? Another incredibly important play as you put your tournament life on the line through her.
Yeah, this is a fun story. I'll save it for my JK plus one with Marshall, exactly the steps before I bet $40,000 on her to win. Look, she's just such a cool horse, you know, and she ran 15 times. She won 13. She lost as a 2-year-old and she got disqualified to whether that was Delaware or Parks.
Oh, that was a bloody result for me, JK. How can you not it was a bloody result for you, too. How do you not remember that? The cotillion.
I block them out. I block out the bad ones.
I'm the opposite. Man, the bad ones are all I can remember.
She's just so – here's one thing I love about her is, as a speed figure player, her speed figures were not, like, overly dominant when you're looking at a race about to bet $40,000 on a horse. But one thing that was dominant was – she's just a badass, and she will not let horses finish in front of her. She just keeps going and keeps grinding. And I don't know a lot about horses' action. Hers is not the most beautiful, and she still just keeps coming. And it's one of my favorite things about racehorses is their determination. And I think Whitmore is actually a horse I know we'll talk about at least for a second. That's what's kind of cool about him. He's just a hard knocker, hard trier, and Monomoy Girl was that. So looking forward to seeing her run again.
Well, that was the big news. Sold at the Night of the Stars and going to come back into training. To me, I mean, obviously I'm thrilled she's still running. Watching her beat up on her division again is cool, but doesn't, like, get the blood pumping. What gets me excited is the idea of her picking one of these mile and an eighth targets against males and trying that, whether that be the Pegasus or the Saudi race. What do you think is going to happen with Monomoy Girl in terms of potential targets for this year?
Well, you know, I think the first thing to consider is, if I'm not mistaken, the Saudi race is a mile and an eighth on a one-turn mile and an eighth. So is, you know, Brad will need to decide, I'm assuming Brad will keep her. We need to decide if that's going to fit her. But it is a great gamble. I love the gamble by Spendthrift. You know, you pay $9.5 million for her, but you're out if you can win the race before she even goes to do her career that you were paying $9.5 million for her to do. So it's a pretty cool gamble. It's an interesting move. I would think maybe the Pegasus might be a race that makes more sense. You take a lot of the equation out of it with having to travel across the country. You go down to South Florida. The race hasn't been particularly strong as of late. Who are you going to see in there? That's, you know, we'll see what happens, but or why not both? They're not too close, right?
You could do both. I mean, she obviously loves plenty of time between her races. And then I guess the question becomes, do you think about going straight ahead to this year's Pegasus? And given what that race is going to likely look like, that might make a whole lot of sense, don't you think, as opposed to planning for a year out?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, and try to hit a couple of those big pots to help pay for the investment. B. Wayne Hughes has been known to be a good businessman. This looks like it could be a good business move.
And what a notion, JK. You really think they'd take Monomoy Girl away from Brad Cox? That would be like you turning up on somebody else's podcast network.
I didn't think they would, but I've seen crazier things.
No, I know. That was just a setup to make that joke.
Oh, good.
Let's talk Breeders' Cup Mile. The story here, obviously, the Aidan O'Brien 1-2-3 and Order of Australia, possibly, in my view, JK, an underlay at 73-1. A slow stayer getting a brilliant ride and somehow getting the prize money. I mean, Aidan O'Brien, man, what an achievement. Just as some respected stats people were starting to talk about him as a bet against in Breeders' Cup races, comes and does this feat that we've seen on our own shores from Chad Brown and obviously Bob Baffert in dirt races, but to have somebody come from Ireland and pull this off, I think it's in a Breeders' Cup that had a lot of super impressive training feats, the Baffert Exacta in the Classic, the four wins by Brad Cox. I'm not sure this isn't the most impressive of the three. What did you think of the Breeders' Cup Mile?
You know, I didn't have the strongest opinion going into this race. I was kind of basing what I did here in terms of multi-race bets. I didn't make a big play in the BCBC there. Everything I was doing was based on, you know, what you and Nick Luck had talked about on the podcast you guys did together. And it's funny. The only thing I really have coming out of it is that, you know, talking to Nick Luck yesterday, he was pointing out the fact that, and I might, you have the paper in front of you. So if I wasn't driving, I would say the three Europeans that finished well were all on Lasix, and the ones that didn't finish well were all didn't take the Lasix.
There really is a correlation, it feels like to me. It definitely gives an edge, and I don't know why certain trainers don't want to take advantage of it. Aidan O'Brien, I mean, he's interesting in the U.S. He's streaky. He'll go through some seasons that are pretty lean, but it does feel like he's figured out a program that can bring you to the highest level in these USA races. And if other trainers were to ask me, should I Lasix, should I not Lasix, I think it's a total. I think Nick Luck even said on the show, "When in Rome, you know, it's you're seeding it's a certain advantage if you don't do it." And I'd like to see more doing it. So to that point, for me, I really could have used a little bit better trip from Lope E. Fernandez. I don't know that it would have made the difference, but I suspect it might have. That would have been a nice one. But, yeah, didn't make any money in the race. And, in fact, the only people I know who made money in the race, and I talked to a bunch of people who did well here, it was with the old all button. It did open my mind to a Breeders' Cup day where you have strong opinions around a race and you know a race is open. It did open my mind to the idea that, like, that's one place where I would advise against the all button day in, day out, all the time. But in a day like the Breeders' Cup, if you have the right opinions around it and you're doing a weighted all where you have some for the minimum and then you can press the horses you like, I don't think that's a bad idea at all come Breeders' Cup. Are you open to that idea or are you just allergic to all?
No, I mean, it makes sense. But, you know, the moment you do that, you know, Siskin wins, or you know, the 4-to-5 shot wins, and you feel like an idiot. But it does make sense. But I think, like you know, like the kind of the Manny conversation. You know, I think there's a thin line between hindsight and just, you know, just got beat. You know.
I think, though, that the reason I think there's just so much liquidity in the Breeders' Cup pools, if you can drill down, I'm not saying you can do it willy-nilly, but if you can do it around an opinion, like I don't want to be right with, you know, I'm trying to think of a good example. How about if you're right in the Fillion Mare turf about Audaria? Now maybe you say, oh, you just play the pick one, you're getting 17-1, don't be greedy. But then you look at the Breeders' Cup sprint and you're, you know, my opinion there, it was so, if you go back and look at my picks, I probably have favorites in the mix, but it was, I feel like in retrospect, a race where I wasn't that excited to get stuck into any of them. And, you know, and I thought there was a live long shot in Hog Creek Hustle that I would have wanted more than once. So, you know, maybe including the old boy Whitmore would have been a smart thing given his class, the expected pace, and the rest of the field. How shocked were you by Whitmore winning the Breeders' Cup Sprint?
You know, I was pretty shocked. I didn't think he had an excuse last time, but I also didn't think it was a tough race, you know? And so I'm not like, oh my gosh, he's a not good horse and he beat me. You know, he felt like the type of horse that could win that race. And in fact, on my early run, he was a B type. My early run for the race, he was a B type. And only late did I kind of start to kind of lean away from him. But, he's a hard knocker. He's a cool horse. I do think that Pacoma should get Sprinter of the Year. But based on, the Carter and the Met Mile, with us, let's not forget, we thought that Met Mile was going to be the greatest Met Mile ever. So
we'll come back to all these Eclipse discussions. CZ Rocket did run a very good race attending that fast pace and hanging around at the end. But, Whitmore beat him by so much that in performance figure terms, you've just got to give it to him in terms of who was best in the Breeders' Cup Sprint. And it wasn't particularly close.
I agree. Yeah, I agree. CZ Rocket ran well. Frenzy Fire ran well. Again, I'm getting myself a shameless plug on the fact that I like that horse and picked him. He ran pretty good as well. So it wasn't the toughest race. The last couple of years, we've gotten used to that race being a war, especially last year. I thought last year with Chancelot and Matoli and in the Roy H years, it just felt like that race was a war. And I just was kind of underwhelmed by a lot of the horses that were in there. I felt like there was six horses in that race that had absolutely no shot. And that doesn't bode well for how productive the race is going to end up being.
Yeah, that's a good point to my all point. You could still say, hey, well, just be, Whitmore, one that you could, far more predictable than the Orders of Australia's of the world. But I guess in my reckoning, if I were to play at all, something like Whitmore, you'd still have twice, and it just, again, depending on what your surrounding opinions are, it doesn't necessarily cost that much to put them all in there for at least a minimum in case you catch something totally insane like Order of Australia, who I would assume in the picks, the other reason I like it is that in theory, I would assume in the picks, Order of Australia pays much more like the 150-to-1 shot that he really should have been, instead of, to my mind, the underlaid 73-to-1 of the win. Anyway, just a little theory I'm playing.
Here's one thing to keep in mind. Let's just, in the way that I view it, and I'll try to verbalize it if I can, is that when you start hitting the all button, you stop using horses like Ollie's Candy or By My Standards. You stop using those second tier horses that actually have a chance to beat your strong opinions, because you can't. I mean, unless you're spending $20,000, you can't afford it.
You can't afford to play them efficiently. You mean like those are horses that should be included as backups, and then all of a sudden, if you're weighting them the same as a horse with Order of Australia's chances, you're just betting inefficiently.
Yeah, and if you want to hit the all button in the sprint and the all button in the mile, then you have to single Monomoy Girl, and you have to be skinny in the classic, and you can't use B horses in the Monomoy Girl race. You have to be to the and I think that would make a lot of people possibly uncomfortable, maybe not, but that's the thing you have to worry about when you start hitting the all button. Tickets really expensive. You can't have alternatives elsewhere.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And I was thinking about it when I was thinking about it more in terms of like doubles and pick threes and things like that. But to your point, if you really want to, the real way to score would be in the four, pick four, five, and six. And then it does get hard to be efficient. I think it's just all situational and all dependent on what your opinion is. As somebody at times will be a little bit dismissive of the all button, I think it's a club that should mostly stay in the bag. Breeders' Cup Day is a day where I'd at least give it a glance. I guess that's my only point when it comes to that at the end of the day. Let's talk about this filly and mare turf quickly. We talked about the winner, Odaria, who was very good and probably pretty darn haveable, more so than I had given credit for. Rushing Fall, you got to feel bad for Rushing Fall. What a race she ran to just go down in the end. Time Form has them rated equally. I mean, obviously, they just finished the neck ahead. But what did you have any takeaways from this race? I mean, for me, it pretty much ran to form, at least with the top two, when I go back and look at it after the race. What did you think about the race? What surprised you about it?
Nothing really. I mean, she ran well. Rushing Fall ran extremely well. I thought it was interesting, maybe to a certain extent, that me and Mary and Rushing Fall were kind of playing, you know, cat and mouse on the backside there. But I don't think it really affected Rushing Fall or cost her anything. She solidified herself as a great mare, in my opinion. It was fun to see her sell last night. And, it's probably a good time for me to tell this story with all of these people in the game that people like to point out all their faults. There's some good guys, and I just wanted to share with everyone something that Bob Edwards said to me the other day. He reserved the name Kenshin and has invited me to pick a horse in my father's honor.
Awesome.
My dad would be extremely excited about that. He was very proud of our last name, so that was pretty cool and very classy of Bob. So well deserved to have a horse like Rushing Fall.
Now I'm really upset. I'm really upset she didn't win. Now hearing that story, that's a really cool story. What a great thing. We'll have to follow that one in real time, JK. That'll be a horse of great podcast interest, no doubt about it. What else? Mean Mary, kind of disappointing that she fell away so tamely. I'd like to think she's got more in the tank. Don't really know what happened there. Civil Union, I thought ran a pretty solid race with some trouble. I'm hoping she sticks around. I think there could be more to come from her. Any thoughts on the rest of this field?
Now, this is another race where I thought it was a handful of the Euros and Rushing Fall and that we're gonna get the job done. And this was another race where I didn't. You know, I probably wouldn't even have looked at it if I didn't have – it wasn't the first leg of the pick six. I just didn't have a strong opinion. I was hoping Rushing Fall would run better, and I thought Sister Charlie might have a little swan song. But I didn't – you know, I used the 11. I was kind of – what is her name? Audria?
Audaria is what I've been calling her.
Audaria, yeah. I used her as a B horse, just thinking she might get a wide trip, but she definitely ran like an A horse.
Yeah, she really did. I wish I'd pushed more in that direction. And amazing story for Boudot, the rider there, picking up multiple Breeders' Cup winners. Not a bad weekend. It's certainly going to be super helpful for him going forward. Let's get through a few more of these. We'll just speed round things here, JK. I know you got. It sounds like you're driving across the whole darn. Well, not the whole darn state. It's a big state, but we'll do another 15 minutes or so, which means I think we can maybe even get to all of it if we speed round. We'll pause anywhere we want to. Nick's Go. You hear about horses running a hole in the wind. This was really interesting to me because I heard a lot of sharp people like questioning whether he should be such a heavy favorite and all these things. I mean, I just felt like this was a case of a horse with the best numbers, or at least the best last number, clearly in a whole new realm in the new barn, really the form for the new barn, which is obviously flying, was the only thing I cared about. And then just everything came in the horse's favor between the way that speed was holding and the specific configuration of the two-turn mile. I advised betting him to the Brits when he was 7-1, but and you know 9-5. Certainly, I'm not going to say that was an overlay, but he sure ran like it was. Very, very impressive stuff, and it was one of those things where even when it looked like it was too fast, visually going forward, I was thinking to myself like Rosario, like this is a guy who saved something, saved a lot more than I thought. Just blows this race apart. It was an impressive performance.
Yeah, you know, one of my favorite things to see when you like a horse in the front end and they're going fast, I like to see who is close to him, like who's second, third, and fourth. Because what usually happens in those situations, or at least often, is the contenders are second, third, and fourth. And I love it when that happens because they're going fast too.
Yeah.
It's not like they're going to have this late kick that Nick's Go is not going to have, because they're right up there in the mix. And I felt like everyone who I thought could beat him was close to him. And if you're close to him, you know, he's dragging you along with his coattails, and you're going just as fast. So, look, he had just run entirely too fast in his last race at Keeneland. If he was going to duplicate that, they weren't going to beat him. And he did. He duplicated that performance, and he did it and one of my favorite trips possible, wire to wire, but like blistering fast wire to wire.
I love that observation about making the others, like, based on where they are in the race, knowing that that's making them go too fast too. It's one of the reasons why you can find some really interesting exacta angles with dominant speed horses like Nick's Go, and why maybe it's not so surprising that a 60-to-1 shot like Jesus's team ends up being second there. And that's not just, this is no anomaly, folks. You know, obviously we got a lot of seasoned horse players listening, but we got some newer people too. This is a pattern you'll see a lot, that dominant speed horse beats up the other theoretical contenders, the sharp samurais, the complexities, and it sets it up for that, the horse that Mike Maloney might call a dinker to come in. Often those horses you look at for third and fourth, but in the right situation, they can run second too and give you a very pleasing exacta. That's what happened in the Breeders' Cup Dirt Mile. As for the Breeders' Cup Turf Sprint, I think we'll just spend the next 3 minutes giving props to Naomi Tucker and especially Sean Borman. And the only reason I say especially to Sean Borman is because I know he spoke about Glass Slippers, the winner here, to both you and Marshall. So he had a little bit of a hand anyway in the Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge exacta. I don't know if we ever officially said that it was Marshall Graham. I think we did up top. Marshall Graham ended up just getting you at the wire there in the BCBC. But was Glass Slippers on your radar before you spoke to Sean?
No, absolutely not. And here's the thing. I want to thank all the fine people of Lexington, Kentucky, who were in the Chick-fil-A drive-thru line. Because I pulled in to go to the drive-thru, and the line was ridiculous. And so I was like, oh, I'm not doing this. So instead of – what I did is I started to pull out, and that's – I was driving through, like, where Sean kind of lives. And I was like, you know, let me call Sean. So I called Sean. And that's when we had the conversation where he told me how much he liked Glass Slippers. I think Sean had like done some figure work to like try to make figures for these some of these European horses, and Glass Slippers had a huge one for him. So when I did my all-in with doubles, I made sure to use that one.
And that was also very interesting. Not a race you'd normally consider putting your tournament life on the line in, a wide-open affair like the Breeders' Cup Turf Sprint. And I won't say this for you. I'll ask it as a question. You know, why did you decide to put your life on the line in a race that can historically be kind of chaotic?
Well, I actually don't think turf sprints are that chaotic. I think maybe prices can come in a little bit weird. I think that what usually happens is speed horses win. So you identify all of those. I felt like Leinster, Imprimis were the four types that were kind of separating themselves. I liked Oleksandra coming from out of it. I didn't like Got Stormy. So I felt like there was throwing in Sean's opinion of Glass Slippers. I thought it set me up well, you know, into that opinion of Nick's Go with a little bit of complexity sprinkled in. And I knew that I wanted to try to get alive to Bonhomme Girl. So I knew I had to move then in order to be able to do so.
Yeah, it's well put, and that contrarian mindset, thinking, hey, this is a race everybody else thinks is so chaotic, maybe I can get out of here going, you know, 5x2 in the double or however you ended up playing it. And we have to, you did mention the figure work that Sean did. Big assist, JK. You might have to get in on this case of wine we're going to be sending over to Rob Dove, one of the top 10 pro punters in the UK today, who came up with the figure conversions and sectional info that Sean eventually used to come up with this one. Was I smart enough to listen? Of course not. I had said the first time a Breeders' Cup Turf Sprint is won by a European, I was going to get sand kicked in my face. And in fact, when I talked to Sean directly after the race in his inimitable gloating tone, he said, but I thought Europeans couldn't win the Breeders' Cup Turf Sprint.
Oh, Sean, hey, Sean will gloat on you now. You got to watch out for him. If you're sensitive, don't call Sean after he won and you got snagged. He'll get you.
I was laughing my head off. I've never had so much fun getting sand kicked in my face in my entire life, especially knowing how well you guys did. Breeders' Cup Filly and Mare Sprint, you know, maybe was there a little bit of will the real Gamin stand up? She sure did. She blew that field away. Serengeti Empress, so tough. And you would have thought, or I would have thought, with that searching early pace, that one of those closers would have come and gotten her. She hangs on for second. pretty clear who the two best filly and mare sprinters are in the USA. I don't have much on this one, JK, do you?
Yeah, I mean, I think Gamine is a good example of a what-if handicapping angle I'm going to start messing with a little bit in some of these bigger races with these lightly raced horses. Is the knock on Gamine is that she hadn't ever gone fast early in her one-turn races. Her paces have not been particularly fast. But I think the question you had to ask yourself is, well, what if she would have went fast? Would the outcome have changed? And I know it's a dangerous proposition, and it's probably not one that is a good betting proposition, but, you know, luckily that race was where I didn't need to bet it. And the answer was she absolutely could have been better, you know? And Serengeti Empress is another one, the ballerina. When she goes 21 and change, 44 and change, she's better. But how would you know that if the horse is lightly raced and hasn't had the chance to do it? So, you know, Gamine is a freaky, freaky one-term filly, and she did. She beat them pretty easily.
Let's move on to Friday. How much time we got left? We can go maybe 5 minutes long and get this all done. Breeders' Cup Juvenile won by Essential Quality. There's that man again, Brad Cox. This was a race where I feel like maybe even Jonathan Kinchin 2019 version could have blown the doors off his tournament chances by getting too stuck into Jackie's Warrior, a horse we thought was the bee's knees coming in. This was one, JK, where I had a different take on it when I watched the replay. In real time, I thought he was a little bit disappointing and was thinking, and I'm still of two minds about this question, but my initial thing was, definite cutback. But you looking at the pace figures, I mean, this is just seems like classic move into a hot pace, and he was also, you know, he was also maybe a little bit against the flow of the track. I think it's a pretty darn huge effort. I don't rate him any worse than any of the horses in this race coming out of it. Timeform US agrees with me, has Jackie's Warrior, Hot Rod Charlie, and Essential Quality all rated at the 112. I will say this, physically, he looks like a sprinter to me, but I don't know. That stuff can be deceiving, and I still think he's got a bright future. Essential Quality obviously has pedigree to and is in hands where you could expect him to train on. Was obviously very surprised by Hot Rod Charlie coming in second at 94-1, and Keep Me in Mind as well. Not horses that were really on my radar. And then Rombauer, I'm super interested in going forward because he just looked like one who'd benefit from more distance. So even though he ran significantly slower than the horses I mentioned before, just a horse that has scope to improve, and I could see messing around with in the future. What was your take on this year's Breeders' Cup Juvenile?
You know, I think I'll be simple here. I think the inside was good, and I think the pace was fast. And I think Jackie's Warrior was in the wrong place at the wrong time in both of the situations, and I'd absolutely give him another shot moving forward. I felt like the race kind of fell apart. I guess the biggest shock to me is Reinvestment Risk just didn't run well at all. I thought Reinvestment Risk would run better, and I was just wrong about Essential Quality. I'm like that from time to time where, you know, when I feel like there's three horses that can win and one of them I love, then I just can't use all three. It just feels so inefficient to me to have that extra combination. And I picked the wrong one, obviously, when I was trying to make a decision between Reinvestment Risk and Essential Quality.
For the second choice. Yeah. So yeah, I'll just make this one note about Reinvestment Risk, who I saw no excuse on track for. He, to me, just like horse flesh wise, was one of the most impressive looking specimens of the entire weekend. I love this horse on looks. I got that overwhelming intuition that he'd run well. Obviously, it didn't work out. And, you know, I mean, it's not exactly a secret, I guess, given what this horse cost, that he'd look so good. But I'm very tempted to just keep an eye on him. And I wonder if there won't be a day where he'll be a good bet as well, if he gets lost in the shuffle somewhere down the line. I still think that horse has talent. We'll have to wait and hear what the story was. Breeders' Cup Juvenile Fillies Turf, a.k.a. the Aunt Pearl Show. you know, super duper impressive. Went to the front, improved position, solidified the spot at the top of the division. Really turned this into to an absolute one horse race. I don't have too much here. Maybe Campanella wants to go shorter. Nice job by Mother Earth, the real one this time, to come running on for second. Another opinion that Sean was able to derive from Dove stuff that I completely whiffed on. These guys are making me look like an amateur this weekend. But, you know, really, to me, this one was just all about Aunt Pearl.
Yeah, I don't really have a lot to add. She was unbelievable. You know, she was it's such a weapon. It's such a weapon in general to be able to be so aggressive on the front end, on the turf. We talked about it with Channel Maker, but it's even more it's more of a weapon to me when you finish like a closer, like she kicks, like Newspaper of Record used to kick. And also these young horses that are trying to figure out how to run. They're still trying to figure out their job, and they're trying to figure out exactly what they're supposed to do. And they got some gorilla that's four lengths in front of them running fast. I think it's just a lot for young horses that are, you know, chasing behind that to try to figure out.
Oh, so I don't get accused of a host fail. Let's loop back to Saturday for 1 second and talk about Nashville. I think that might have been while you were in the drive-through or thinking about going through the Chick-fil-A drive-through, so maybe you didn't even see it. Did you see the Nashville performance? And there's some interesting figure controversy on this one.
No, I didn't even see it because, well, for one, I was scrambling to get going in the right direction. But I also knew that if I turned it on, I'd be tempted to concoct some pick five, $25 pick five, and start my day off on the wrong foot.
Well, we'll talk about that later. It is. I mean, it seems to me that the Nashville figure should be faster than the Breeders' Cup Sprint, and I don't know. I have to examine more, but it sure doesn't seem crazy that Nashville could have won the thing had that been the way that the cookie crumbled. But you didn't see the race. We'll talk about that later. Breeders' Cup Juvenile Fillies. V-Quist gets the job done. This was a race, JK, where you predicted the winner from a long way out. I was very impressed with your race watching skill.
The rail was good, and I thought it was an evenly matched bunch. I think the questions about Princess Noir and the fact that she was drawn towards the outside and was getting kind of an outside trip, I didn't trust she was going to get the job done. And the first person that brought V-Quist to my attention, I'll give some credit to, was Dermot Magner, the trainer up in New York that if you play New York, you'll be familiar with seeing his name. Dermot had seen her work in the morning and said that she was something.
That's interesting. I didn't even know that bit. You guys are holding out on me, but I've been a V-Quist fan just off the tape. And the other storyline here, as JK very politically correct alluded to, the Princess Noor situation. I'll just come out and say it, stealing Nick Tamaro's brilliant tweet: figures don't lie.
Oh no, for sure they don't. And it's not like there hasn't been situations where horses overcome that, but I think 95% of the time you get what you got on Friday.
Let's talk about the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Turf Fire at Will. How much do we talk about Mike Maker on the shows? And, you know, this was another one. You go back, and I can see it if I squint, and I got kind of mad at myself about JK. Mike Maker winning a Breeders' Cup race after winning one of the historical key preps. Yeah, I get it. If the horse is 6-1, you say, eh. But I mean, at 30-1, how did we let this happen?
I don't know. I mean, loose on the lead like that, you know, I was on that day and I remember thinking how awesome of a ride it was by Kendrick. And I just, loose on the lead, I typically don't like betting horses off of awesome ride. You know, it's just not usually a winning proposition. I felt like we had some coverage elsewhere. Ricardo rode the horse beautifully. Hindsight's 20/20, I guess, but that's kind of the issue with that, with those. It's kind of the issue with lightly raced horses is the race that we had to really kind of decide if we liked him on was the race at Belmont where he got loose and they were slow. So, you know, you had to kind of close your eyes and imagine, well, what happens if he's in a normally run race? And and maybe you could find them that way. But that one's not haunting.
That's interesting. It really bothers me because it's just about value. I know what you're saying. Like, you're never supposed to pick the horse, but if you're pricing up the race, how do you make him longer than 10-1 on his resume and his trainer? You know, like he'd be my eighth pick. But I'll bet my eighth pick if they're 30-1 for winning connections. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think it's the European. I think the Europeans take. I think the Europeans are always overbet in those races.
It's interesting. Well, Battleground ran very well. No threat to the winner, but a horse I think who's going to have a bright future. We've seen this Breeders' Cup Juvenile Turf be a key prep for the Derby in recent years, the big one at Epsom. And I once made the mistake of referring to that race as the Epsom Derby to an English racing aficionado who quickly corrected me that that's just the Derby. All the others, you know, came out or imitations of it, which is absolutely true, but also fantastically English and snobby to point out. But anyway, Battleground, big future ahead. I want to do some more work on that race to see who else is interesting coming out of it. My main point was just to say it's hard sometimes. I get so stuck into selections, it's hard to remember that the real way to bet in the big picture of life is to actually price these things up. And in that case, I think I would have at least started something or saved in some degree with that horse at that price. I feel like Breeders' Cup Day, I feel like day in, day out racing, the stuff you were saying makes so much sense about why you fade a horse like that and you don't even think about it. But again, Breeders' Cup Day at that kind of price, I feel like I should have done something somewhere. One more Breeders' Cup race to talk about. Breeders' Cup Juvenile Turf Sprint. It was the Golden Pal show. Maybe a little bit shorter in odds than we expected, but we thought it was going to be a one-horse race, and that's exactly what ended up happening. And hey, we gave out in our little videos, we ended up giving out the exacta here as well. So hopefully some folks got a little bit of gravy, as my friend Emmett Kennedy would say, in this one. What did you think of Golden Pal? How good is this one going to be?
Yeah, I thought he was good. You know, I thought he was really, really good. He's, you know, he popped from the outside like a shot and was like four clear. And then I think so at some point in the race, I did what everyone else who bet on him did, said, Irad, what are you doing? Because he, like, let everyone back in the race. And I don't know if Irad thought he was. I was standing with George Weaver, and obviously George can watch a race and understand some of those things that you know, even some of us horse players don't. He thought maybe Irad just felt like, oh, man, I'm going too fast. And when he asked him to slow down, the horse is handy enough that he slowed down, but then everyone else was hurrying up to catch up to him because he was going so fast. It was kind of one of those, you know, slamming on your brakes in the middle of the highway type of deals.
It wasn't pretty, that's for sure, but it worked out. Whatever it was, it worked out. I would think that Ascot will be on the cards for Golden Pal again. You think I'm reading between the lines here? You think Irad might have got away with one there?
I mean, I think Irad and the horse got away with one. You know, I mean, I understand maybe what he was thinking. I mean, I would have rather him just keep running, but it worked out. So it's not like it's, you know, no harm, no foul.
All's well that ends well seems to be your ultimate take on it. I think he may have gotten away with one, but like you said, the money still spends for backers and connections. And who knows? Maybe the horse learned something doing that, and then maybe, you know, 5.5, pretty sharp for a turf sprint. Maybe he'll be able to go a little bit longer, or be able to have more gas left in the tank going a straight 5 or even a straight 6 at Ascot next year, depending on what race they're going to ultimately point him to. I'm already looking forward to that one. Speaking of all's well that ends well, JK, I think we should wrap this one. Please, we got through everything, and I'm being a little less salty than I was when we did this podcast last year at Lucky Baldwin's, if you remember. I was completely running off.
Yeah, you were on the muscle that day, and I was getting ready to get in an Uber to go to Las Vegas. A little bit of a different trip for me now. I'm in a car going home.
Very, very true. All right. Updates on the network this week. you know, well, I'll be back for the picks show later in the week. JK plus one going to be appearing tomorrow. JK with his special guest, Marshall Graham. I expect there to be some great insight into tournament play and horse playing in general.
We're doing video, Pete, by the
way. Oh, you didn't tell me that. I love it.
We're doing video, and Craig DTF Stable is going to mix in some of the video of the races while we're talking about it. I talked to Pete Rotundo's idea yesterday while we were all saying our goodbyes one last time. That was his idea, so
brilliant.
Getting the footage won't be an issue.
That's absolutely brilliant. Oh, I can't wait. I can't wait to see that. And then you're also going to be on maybe with Naomi later in the week. Did I hear a rumor about that?
Yeah, I'm going to make Naomi and Spencer fight in like a cage match.
Oh, I'm going with Naomi. She's got the reach advantage, and she fights dirty. So, Spencer, get ready to do the job. Other stuff, I don't know. Thanks to everybody who bought the premium package. We got a lot of great feedback on that. We'll probably send out a survey or something to try to learn something. I know already a few things we can do better, but that was a lot of fun. Hope everybody enjoyed the coverage. From the comments we've gotten, from the download numbers, it sure sounds like people dug it, and we loved being there, and we understand how privileged we were to be there, and hopefully being the eyes and ears of our listeners and horse players around the world. That's something that we take very seriously. All right, let's wrap things up. I'll thank you, JK. We'll thank our friends at 10 Strike Racing, especially Marshall Graham, because let me tell you, folks, if you know how he gets, imagine how insufferable JK would be if he'd actually won the thing. So we have Marshall and 10 Strike to thank for that. JK's on mute. I'm hoping he's laughing and not offended by that comment. Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation, we'll thank them as well. I think we have, I'm not joking, about two bottles left of the In the Money whiskey. If you're interested, trfinc.org/players, make your donation there, and you can get one of the last remaining bottles. This is a serious, we're in serious you snooze, you lose territory on that one. I thank the people who bought the premium package. I just want to take time to thank all of you, the listeners, as well, for making these shows so much fun to do and being this is cheesy, but just allow me, the wind that keeps our sails over here at the In the Money Media Network afloat. We're always around to answer questions, your horse playing questions, whatever questions, really, inthemoneypodcast.com through the contact page or on Twitter. I'm at Looms Boldly. He's at UT Big Hair. Before I do the close, JK, do you have a final thought for the people?
No, I got so many nice messages. And so, you know, if you did send me a message, I tried to respond or at least like the tweet. Thank you to everyone who with the nice comments about the BCBC.
As much as he's happy about the nice comments, folks, if he's being honest, he's much more happy about the 16 people he made throw up.
Oh, yeah. When I got home that night, I had me a couple of glasses of wine. Once I finally got in bed, you know damn well I went and searched a couple of last names and giggled before I went to sleep.
That's going to do it. This show's been a production of In the Money Media. Our business manager is Drew Cotney. Our chief creative officer is Jonathan Kinchin. I'm Peter Thomas Fornital. May you win all your photos.